Up next, listen to the future of the internet with WebTalk and hear the latest news and trends keeping those electronic circuits and broadband connections buzzing.
This week, we talk with the author of a weblog who explains how this new communication device may be threatening the major media outlets. Also this week, we talk about the continued growth of online e-commerce and a new enterprise software package that helps e-tailers from the CEO of Mercent.com.
Stay connected. WebTalk is coming up next.
WebTalk Radio is brought to you by Web.com, the most trusted name on the net. When you're ready to get on the web, visit Web.com for domain names as low as $4.95. Web.com offers full-featured web hosting, including online store packages, starting at only $7.95 per month. Web.com has thousands of .web.com names available at www.web.com.
You are listening to WebTalk at WebTalkRadio.com, and my name is Rob Greenlee, and thanks for joining us again this great weekend from all over the world. And we like to keep you plugged into the latest net trends and the coolest internet-connected devices out there. And please tell all your friends and workmates about the show at WebTalkRadio.com and keep us in mind.
Yeah, do our little marketing evangelism word of mouth. You know, when we plug them in, does it create this electrical shock?
I mean, because... Not normally.
I don't want to harm our listeners.
No, we don't, but we want to shock them with knowledge.
I might want to shock them any other way I can think of. Well, I'm Dana Greenlee, and we're bringing you some internet happenings this week. Actually, more than happenings, we're going to kind of spout off on our own thoughts about some things.
Well, yeah, these are just things that we have observed, and one of them is video weblogs is the next big weblogging trend.
Ah, and my personal impact of View Source and its growth on the web.
The death of who is, and you probably ask, what is, and who is, what is? And we're going to tell you all about it.
We're opening our digital mailbag. We'll talk about an email we got from David in Houston, Texas. He talks about USA patriotism, which is interesting because Texas is very patriotic.
Yes, it is, as the Republican convention is about ready to start.
Well, up next after our news, we'll be speaking with good old web guy, Frank Catalano. He's a tech analyst on TV and radio. He's been on NPR. He's a regular contributor to WebTalk. He's also a writer and tech consultant for Catalano Consulting. You can find that at catalanoconsulting.com. He's going to talk about his recent blog posting. It refers back to an article he wrote in 1992. What he called dinosaurs at the time would slowly change because of the influence of new technologies like weblogs and cable channels like Fox News.
There's an evolution of basically the ability to publish information to a wide audience and distribute it, getting down to the citizen level. A 30-year ongoing process of the democratization of information, where the barriers to entry for somebody who wants to get their view known is dropping lower and lower and lower, and is making it easier and easier to get an individual voice out to many, many millions of people.
Later on the show today, we're also going to be joined by a gentleman by the name of Eric Best, who is the founder and CEO of Mercent.com, a Seattle-based company who is coming out of the closet of sorts with a new enterprise software package that e-commerce retailers can use to submit through one interface to all major e-marketplaces like Amazon.com, Frugal, MySimon, and many others. They also allow for optimizing search engine placement of these products and to sell products online. He's also going to talk about the changes that online e-commerce is going through as it grows up and starts to pull really huge sales numbers.
There are some critical benefits that these well-known marketplaces provide to retailers who are selling through these venues. Obviously, the number one benefit is customer base. I mean, Amazon has on the order of 42 million unique accounts who are actively buying. It's hard to think of another way that you can get your products exposed to that set of customers as quickly and easily as you can through a site like Amazon.com.
It's time for the aforementioned, our take on the web this week. Well, video weblogging. I want to talk about video weblogging right now because that's something that's near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, it is.
Thinking about it.
Well, and most of the stories this week are observations that Dana and I have made, as well as things that we're seeing talked about online. And these are significant trends that maybe aren't really being talked about much in the major media out there. So you're hearing kind of an exclusive deal on the show this week. But video weblogs has been talked about for a long time, along with audio weblogs. But I think video video weblogs may actually catch a little more traction than audio.
Of course. Wouldn't you rather watch and listen rather than just listen? I mean, generally, yes. But, of course, there's been huge barriers. Obviously, bandwidth. Obviously, people's machines and the ability to create and store and stream.
But, you know, really one of the key things you got to keep in mind is that a lot of the younger people that are coming up are what is being termed kind of the TV generation, which
yes,
means that they've grown up with TV. I know my kids love television, and I think everything's going to be moving over to broadband more. I think as we get more high-speed connections into the home, into the workplace, into even mobile phones and wireless connections, you're going to see video going everywhere, and that's really what this is all about.
Well, I know this. I mean, the kids these days, there's an assumption, just an assumption, that the computer monitor is just like another TV monitor. We were there when the net was unfolding, and it was just kind of a little bit like, oh, we can do that? Well, this is great.
Well, it's going to be easy for them, especially if we have fiber optics coming into the home.
Well, here's some examples. I know you gleaned through some ideas of how video can be used on the web as far as the content in your weblog, and it's a great, for instance, one of them is storytelling. You get on there and you talk, you tell your story, you tell something about your life or fiction or something like that, but via video, talking head.
Well, and it needs to have some punch to it. It needs to have something that's spectacular about it, too. It's just like what you see on television. A lot of what's popular online, as well as on television, is it's got to be kind of sensational. It's got to be kind of fun. Exactly. Or funny. And then
naked news.
Some of the other things that are popular in video weblogs would be tours of things that haven't been seen yet. So if they're popular things that maybe people know about, but they've never seen it or something
that. Not like my bathroom or anything.
Well, I suppose it could be if it's really an entertaining bathroom. You never know.
Demos of things. This is a spectacular part. But demos of items that you want to demonstrate maybe how something works or operates that no one's seen. I mean, why do you want to read text about how to change printer ink? I don't know. And, you know, you can have just watch a demonstration of that.
Oh, yeah. And a good example of that was recently when we had the folks on from Motorola talking about their new MPX phone. We put a link on our website to a really short video that really showed people how to actually use that phone. And I think it really helped people grasp what was revolutionary about that.
Yeah, 3Top needs to make a video weblogging work for people. What's that about?
Unlimited storage and bandwidth. I think those are fairly normal thoughts when it comes to video and what you need to actually do that. And then the file sharing capability too, being able to send it to a friend, you know, BitTorrent technology, those kind of things.
Just being able to port it over onto your TV, which I know we're getting the media center. There's Prismic is the device. Ways to watch it so it's more convenient for the whole family. And basically what we're looking at is it'll be just like talking on the phone, writing a letter, getting mail, except this is how you're going to communicate. So we're all sort of going to become our little broadcast network to different people.
That's true.
You know, maybe to 15 people I'll broadcast something, or, you know, but it's our way of communicating, not typing anymore. Thank goodness in my wrists.
Yeah, but there's some dangers with that, too, because, you know, we're not always looking our most presentable, like early in the morning or something like that. So
I think you can decide when the camera is. Well, ViewSource. This is my favorite. I mean, ViewSource is explain what it is, but we've used it since day one of the internet.
Well, yeah, it's one of those things that everybody just takes for granted, and there's probably a lot of people out there that don't even know what we're talking about. It's the capability of viewing the behind-the-scenes code of a web page within a browser. It's always been part of the browser capabilities.
Navigational thing. You just click on, what is it, view, and then down to source, or you can right-click on any web page and a menu pops up, you click View Source. You see the HTML, the code, the strange, odd code.
Yeah, and what really sparked this is something that was important is, you know, the new browsers like Firefox are coming out, and the developers are saying, well, we're going to support, you know, some of these long-standing features that have been in a web browser since the very early days, like Netscape One, and because they were really one of the core features. This View Source is one of the core features that really propelled the internet and the web forward.
Well, it was the way we could steal code and make our own web page. Copying, pasting, hacking, cutting.
People learned a lot about how to build web pages and about HTML by being able to view it and manipulate it. This is one thing that's not going to go away, I guess, is what the bottom line
is. Hallelujah.
Yep.
Well, you know, and there's secret ways you find out stuff about where people are, you know, just by the code. If you just rely on the graphics, you're not going to get the whole picture.
No, that's right.
Rob, who is? Another one of those stalwarts from the early days of
the
internet.
Well, Dana, exactly who is who is?
Who is the most fantastic database that I think, in a way, it's like an open secret. A lot of people who have to do with the web, certainly if you register domain names, you're probably aware of it. But then a lot of people are just browsers, have no, you know, viewers of the web. don't know what Whois is.
Well, it's just a list or a database of all of the registered owners of domain names, and it's been around for a long time. It was started back with Network Solutions back in the early days when the web was just getting off the ground, and a person could go in and search for a domain name, and you could see who actually owned that domain name and maybe even contact them if you wanted to buy that domain name from them. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, snoop around. But what's happening is companies like GoDaddy now are starting to charge $6.95 per year per domain to actually have that information removed from the Whois database.
Oh, interesting. Pay to have it.
Well, it's for your privacy reasons.
You know, I'll miss that. I hope that's not the case. It's kind of interesting. I have to quick share a story. I bought the domain boston-legal.org. It's Boston Legal is a TV show that's going to premiere in the fall from the David E. Kelley Productions. I was trying to register the domain name Boston Legal. All those other versions are gone. And the day that I was registering boston-legal.org, boston-legal.net was registered by the David E. Kelley Productions mm-hmm. for their show. It's still a dead link. But what's interesting is there, you can view all the, you can view the email address of the person who registered it, all the, you know, the official name. Whereas David E. Kelley Productions at ustinka.com has like no contact information. Mm-hmm. So they are not like a place where you can just find out where they're located, and certainly not the email information online.
But people have been able to do that for a long time. I know I've done it many times through the years to try and find a person's phone number that maybe it wasn't on their website, you know.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So anyway, that may be going into the past is a functionality that we can use in the future. So well, anyway, we got a mailbag, digital mailbag.
Yeah, David from Houston, mm-hmm. Texas wrote us.
He wanted to tell us about a website that he has, and he thought our listeners might be interested. It's a U.S. Patriotism website at usa-patriotism.com. And what this site does is it showcases, I guess, poems, patriotism poems, articles, stories, quotes, music, and all sorts of things. And the reason I wanted to mention this is because the Republican National Convention is coming up this weekend, and it's probably going to be a very patriotic experience, even if you're from outside the United States, and find out what U.S. patriotism is all about. David, thank you for the email. We appreciate it and bring it to our attention. And if you have something that you would like to share with us, please send me an email at rob@webtalkradio.com, and we'd be happy to mention it on the air.
Support for Web Talk every week is provided at our friend. Provided by our friends at Serenade Audio. WebTalk's now officially available on Serenade Audio. You can find that at serenadesystems.com/WebTalk. And in fact, you can get not just WebTalk Radio on there, you get tons of NPR shows and Kin Radio and a lot of music. Just fantastic selection.
Oh, yeah, you can get tons and tons of audio content to your MP3 player. We're also supported by Web.com, the most trusted name on the net. And if you're ready to get a domain name or a site hosted, it's got the lowest prices available at $6.95 per year for a regular .com domain name and $7.95 per month for a e-commerce website. Can't get any better deal than that.
No kidding.
So go check out web.com.
And finally, InfoCreek.com, our tried and true website design firm that is working on our new site. We love them. They're very talented people, and you can go to InfoCreek.com if you want a website designed by them.
And also go check out downloadradio.org. It's a great place to download some radio shows like Web Talk as well.
Up next, stay tuned, because joining us in seconds, Frank Catalano. He's a blogger. He writes BiteMeOnline.com, and he's a radio and TV tech analyst. He'll be here to talk about his new blog posting, referring to an article about major media journalism and whether they're dinosaurs.
This is Web Talk Radio. This is Rob Greenlee of Web Talk Radio. If you currently would like to listen to music and talk radio programming on your MP3 player, I've got an insider tip on a cool new download service called Serenade Audio. Serenade Audio is a revolutionary new radio service that's going to change your MP3 player listening experience. Serenade Audio enables you to schedule and automatically download Web Talk Radio, NPR, Ken Radio, and over 300 other top talk, sports, and entertainment radio programs right to your MP3 player through your PC. You'll be able to listen anytime, anywhere, at home, on the go, or at the gym. And when you sign up for Serenade Audio and download the software, you'll receive over 100 free music channels for your desktop. And Serenade Audio also offers a 15-day trial on the download before you buy. So listening to the radio on your schedule doesn't get any easier, so go visit Serenade Audio at serenadesystems.com/webtalk and start downloading today. Hi, this is Rob Greenlee of Web Talk Radio. I've got a tip for you. If you're looking to register a new domain name or get a new website hosted, then support the Web Talk Radio show by visiting web.com. They have been a trusted name on the web for years and have had over 300,000 customers over the years. They specialize in domain name registrations and hosting, but they have a domain name registration as low as $4.95 per year, and that's for a yourname.web.com domain name. And they also have regular .com domain names for $6.95 per year. Web.com was recently ranked number one by tophosts.com and CNET certified as being a top web hosting provider. Their hosting plans are as low as $7.95 per month, and that's even for an online e-commerce solution. So trust me, web.com is a great place to get your solution, and you can give them a call at 1-800-761-2468. That's 1-800-761-2468, or just visit them right on their website at web.com. You're back with Web Talk at webtalkradio.com, and my name is Rob Greenlee, and Dana Greenlee is in here as well.
And with us is Frank Catalano. He's a tech analyst. He's been on TV and radio at places like NPR and Fox, and he's a regular contributor to Web Talk. He's also a writer and tech consultant at Catalano Consulting. You can find that at catalanoconsulting.com. And Frank has a blog, and that's what he's going to talk about today. Frank's articles appear on webtalkradio.com, but his web blog is at bitemeonline.com. That's BYTEmeOnline.com.
Frank is on the line with us, and he's going to talk about his recent blog posting that refers to an article he wrote back in 1992 that gave some perspective on how major media, or as he calls dinosaurs, are changing solely because of the influence of new technology and web blogs. And this article that he wrote back then didn't talk anything about web blogs or even the web, but talked about PCs' growing use. But he continues that theme right into talking about what's happening today and that web blogs will not kill major media or journalism. Frank, it's great to be speaking with you again on the show. I appreciate you joining us again.
My pleasure.
Your recent blog that you posted to your website talked about an article that you had written back in 1992, and it talked about how the major media were kind of viewed, and actually the article talks about them in regards that they're kind of a dinosaur of the airwaves back in 92 and leading up to today. And one of the interesting things that that you posed right at the beginning of the blog was whether or not there's going to be a slow death of traditional media in the face of the growth of new technology, and whether or not the era of information and how savvy citizens out there are going to be gaining access to audiences, not unlike what WebTalk is doing and what we're doing on this show. Why don't you kind of run through some of those large issues there and give us kind of a glimpse on what your bigger vision is, you know, in the article itself and how it kind of lays this out. I think this is a very important topic as it relates to the growth of democracy and kind of how this whole information technology area is growing and developing.
Well, before I get into that, I think it might be important to point out, why in the world are we talking about an article that was written in 1992?
Well, that's a good question, Frank. Well, I mean, it's really fascinating because the article, when you really read it and really understand and maybe not really focus on some of the keywords that you have in there, because some of them are really old, some of the media in there and some of the references, is really applicable to today. So you were a good predictor of the future, I think, in this article.
Well, I appreciate that. I think, you know, one key thing is I kept hearing, and what inspired me to go back to this 1992 essay I wrote, was I kept hearing a lot of people out there who are very much into weblogs and pushing weblogs, and I have a weblog myself, so I like weblogs, but saying that weblogs will result in citizen journalism, it will result in the death of traditional media, and all this over-the-top stuff, like you get when a teenage boy, for example, has discovered girls for the first time and thinks they're the greatest things in the world. It's like people who were wannabe journalists had discovered blogs and decided that was the way they were going to take over the world. So I thought about all these predictions that weblogs were going to destroy journalism and traditional media companies, and I said, you know, this sounds awfully familiar.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back to an article, an essay I'd written, about a 5,000 to 6,000 word essay I'd written for Analog Science, Fact, and Fiction, which came out in July of 92. And it was called When Dinosaurs Ruled the Airwaves. And back then, I was looking at all the trends that were occurring in technology as they applied to journalism. And back then, the hot trends were things like personal camcorders that you could take around, things like computer bulletin board systems for spreading information, things that today we take for granted as old technology, but back then were pretty new. Things like cheap satellite time, where almost anybody could syndicate a radio show.
Mm-hmm.
So, and at that time, there were people saying that, hey, guess what, this is going to change the world. And it did. So my point was, looking at today, 12 years later, in 2004, that these things did change the world, and they continue to change the world in what I call the democratization of information. But what weblogs are doing to traditional media is really no different than things like computer bulletin boards and portable camcorders and those types of technologies we're doing to traditional media 12, 14 years ago. It is a continuation. It is an evolution of basically the ability to publish information to a wide audience and distribute it, getting down to the citizen level. That's really what we've been looking at. So we're looking at basically a trend that goes back not just to the essay in 92, but probably back another 10 or 20 years prior to that, a 30-year ongoing process of the democratization of information, where the barriers to entry for somebody who wants to get their view known is dropping lower and lower and lower, and is making it easier and easier to get an individual voice out to many, many millions of people.
Oh, yeah, it certainly is getting easier.
Well, one thing, too, that I think that that then raises is, if this becomes so easy, is that a good thing? It's a good thing in the way that a lot more voices can be heard. It's a bad thing if you're the one who's within listening range of all the voices. And a bad thing only in the sense that all of us have limited attention spans.
Mm-hmm.
We only have so much time. So we tend to gravitate to media sources, whether they're on the internet, on television, on the radio, in print, that are things that we can count on and trust, or at least entertain us at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody trusts a Big Brother, for example, a TV show, not the Orwellian perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that as you have the barrier to entry dropping for distribution of information, suddenly you have people being overwhelmed, like trying to drink out of a fire hose, with all these new information sources. And what happens then is people start to decide, what filters do I trust to help me get through this stuff?
Yeah.
And that's where we are with weblogs right now, to specifically talk about weblogs. Some of the more popular weblogs we're seeing tend to be people who are, first off, reliable in their information, mm-hmm. have a unique perspective, and have a pretty decent audience.
Well, and also have a reputation for being an expert in whatever they're talking about.
Exactly. And I think what we're seeing with weblogs is what we have seen with a lot of other types of media, which is that as the barrier to entry to distribution lowers, a new barrier of entry goes up, which is basically veracity, reputation,
mm-hmm.
voice. In other words, because people have a limited amount of stuff that they can filter when they're reading or taking in information, they're going to naturally try to find people who rise above the noise level of what's common and are worth checking out.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas you have millions and millions and millions of weblogs out there right now, what you really only have are maybe a few thousand that have a significant readership because they are acting as efficient filters or efficient transmitters of information that people feel like it's worth spending their time with.
Yeah. Well, and one other aspect of this is as those grow in popularity and that whole concern about credibility, where does it fit into this whole equation, big media? I mean, is big media going to decline based on the growth of weblogs? My thinking is that's probably not going to happen because it just seems like people trust big media right now. But is that trust kind of eroding too?
Well, I think the trust in big media has been really eroding for a number of decades. I think, though, that what you're going to see is, whereas some people say weblogs will destroy traditional journalism and supplant it, I don't think that's true. I think you will have weblogs that will, in effect, evolve into traditional journalism on their own,
mm-hmm.
just a different set of voices. So it'll become a competing set of traditional journalists, if
yeah,
you will.
Sure.
And I think also you are seeing, just as traditional media has co-opted and adopted satellite technology, websites, the ability to get people to send in their video off their own camcorders.
Mm-hmm.
They are co-opting weblogs to merge into traditional media. Traditional media is not a static thing. It changes. It has changed since the early 1830s when the first daily newspapers were published in New York City.
But it changes very slowly, though, from what I'm seeing.
It does, but there's a lot of competition out there as well to get people's attention. So if it indeed it turns out that weblogs are an effective medium of communication that traditional media can use to get the word out, to get their, if you will, journalism product out, they will co-opt it. The smart ones will,
mm-hmm.
and start using it. But at the same time, this low barrier to entry has allowed for a whole bunch of new voices to start bubbling up, and eventually those will re-aggregate into essentially a traditional media that happens to be a weblog.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the real popular webloggers will ultimately be absorbed by the major media, and that's kind of what we're going to see? Because we're starting to see a little bit of sign of that right now with what CNN has done with weblogs during the political campaign.
We will see some absorbing, but I think also mm-hmm. what you'll see essentially are traditional media voices, or rather I should say weblog media voices, that essentially get so big and so popular, they become traditional media on their very own as independent entities. They're not necessarily absorbed, but they're viewed as equals to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what we're really seeing then is essentially the birth of a new traditional journalism format. Mm-hmm. And I think as some of these weblogs get bigger and more popular, they will find that in order to maintain their audience base and, quite frankly, to maintain their credibility, they have to sort of apply some of the rules of what a good journalism is.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily strictly objectivity. There's a lot of good journalists who are columnists who have strong opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of weblogs that way. But that you put up stuff that you're pretty sure is true, for example, is one of the things. You don't spread spurious rumors. And, you know, the bigger some of these weblogs get, the more likely they might be hit with lawsuits for things like slander and libel.
Sure. Well, that makes sense. Well, now, is one of the core drivers with all this broadband growth? I mean, what do you think is the impact of broadband going to be on media and journalism as we look at it in the future? And will our democracy really get stronger with that? Or is broadband, you think, going to threaten kind of our democracy?
Well, broadband is a fatter pipe. I don't see that as being a threat to democracy. I think it just makes it more easy for people to deliver things like streaming video
mm-hmm.
and audio. I really think the beauty of weblogs is the fact that you don't need broadband to either read or create one. It's anything with a dial-up connection. I mean, a weblog is basically a publishing mechanism. It's a set of tools mm-hmm. that allow anyone to publish something on the internet mm-hmm. easily from anywhere they are.
Yeah, well, it's also the other aspect, too, is just the amount of people that are online, I would think. You know, when I talk about broadband growth, I think what I talk about is just getting more and more people connected to the internet on a wireless basis or on a continual basis, and how that could affect media, too.
Well, I think it basically means that people are going to sources on the internet
mm-hmm.
that they would normally have turned on a radio or a TV set for.
Yeah.
The huge growth of Google News is a great example of that, for example. That's my homepage, myself.
Oh, yeah.
It's the first thing
that's
I
great.
See every morning. I scan it. I laugh a bit at the algorithms and the way they've, you know, screwed up story selection occasionally. But, you know, I think also that also plays to the concept of a filter. Because if you look at Google News, it is essentially a smart filter.
Yeah.
It's kind of your stupid little brother's smart filter because it does kind of odd things that a real human would never do in selection. But when it comes to weblogs and information as a whole, I think we're going to see a lot more of these types of smart filters, whether they are automated or human, that will help us get through all the information that we're currently being hit with from all these various sources.
Well, and that's exactly what the point is that there's so much information out there that we have to have filters to narrow down our interests so we find what we're looking for and not get lost in the clutter.
Agreed. And, I think the bottom line has to do with is weblogs are a great development, but they are an evolution in the democratization of information.
Mm-hmm.
They are not a revolution. And as an evolution, they make it more popular and more easy for people to get a voice out there they have not heard before and to listen to that voice.
Well,
but eventually, it's going to re-aggregate. And some of these weblogs themselves that are so full of themselves right now will suddenly find themselves being considered just like traditional media.
Sure. Well, now, would you consider your blog a form of journalism yourself, or is it some other thing? What is it?
Well, it depends on how you define journalism. Is it a form of reporting? No, because I believe reporting has that standard of at least attempted objectivity. is it fact-based? Yes. Is it commentary and analysis mm-hmm. based on facts? yes. If that's journalism, then it is.
Yeah, well, and I think that the definition of what journalism is probably changing, too.
Well, when you go back to the days of the pamphleteers, you know, back in the 1700s and such, in the 1600s, that was the journalism of the day, and it was highly opinionated, and you were trying to get people to agree with your perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's not a lot of debate over what reporting is. Reporting is essentially, here are the facts, you make up your mind.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of debate about who should be included as a journalist. Are they columnists? I think so. Are they, you know, editorial page writers? Probably.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing journalism, but it is based on fact. It is not reporting, though, which is only fact.
Yeah. And we seem to be seeing a lot of growth in that. I mean, look at stations like Fox News, and those type of broadcast outlets are blurring the lines between pure journalism and opinion.
Well, I think that's the whole concept of this is the one thing I think I got wrong in my original When Dinosaurs Ruled the Airwaves essay mm-hmm. from 1992. I said that a lot of the various stations out there and a lot of the new media outlets that are caused by pushing down the barriers to entry would be forced to report brand new stuff in order to maintain an audience and keep a unique perspective. What I did not think is instead of having a whole bunch of new content, you would have old content with new spins for it for each media outlet.
Yeah, that's
and that's
true.
Really what we've seen.
Yeah.
It's the same old stories, just spun differently for a different demographic or a different political perspective.
Yeah.
So, I miss talk radio. I miss that whole concept of talk TV and talk radio. But,
mm-hmm.
Again, I would have written this as science fiction and not as an essay if I really wanted to have a lot of fun with it.
Sure. Hey, well, Frank, it was great to speak with you again about this topic. Why don't you run through some of the website addresses of some of your sites so some of our listeners can go check out some of the stuff you're doing?
Yes, write very quickly or have a voice transcription product handy. I would recommend they check out my weblog at bitemeonline.com. That's B-Y-T-E, bitemeonline.com. Or if they'd like to find out more about what I do as a technology industry analyst and consultant, they can check out CatalanoConsulting.com, and I will let them guess how to spell Catalano.
They'll probably get it right the first time, right?
Yeah, just it's all A's and one O at the end.
All right. Thank you, Frank. I appreciate the call, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks.
We've been having conversation with Frank Catalano. As he just said, you can look at his weblog at bitemeonline.com and check out CatalanoConsulting.com. Well, hang in there just a little bit longer. Eric Best is joining us. He's the founder and CEO of Mersint.com, a Seattle-based company. He's going to unveil his new enterprise software package that e-commerce retailers are using to submit through just one interface to all the e-marketplaces like Amazon and Google.
This is Web Talk Radio. Hi, this is Rob Greenlee of Web Talk Radio. I've got a tip for you. If you're looking to register a new domain name or get a new website hosted, then support the Web Talk Radio show by visiting web.com. They have been a trusted name on the web for years and have had over 300,000 customers over the years. They specialize in domain name registrations and hosting, but they have a domain name registration as low as $4.95 per year, and that's for a yourname.web.com domain name. And they also have regular .com domain names for $6.95 per year. Web.com was recently ranked number one by tophost.com and CNET certified as being a top web hosting provider. Their hosting plans are as low as $7.95 per month, and that's even for an online e-commerce solution. So trust me, Web.com is a great place to get your solution, and you can give them a call at 1-800-761-2468. That's 1-800-761-2468, or just visit them right on their website at web.com. You're listening to Web Talk at webtalkradio.com, and I'm Rob Greenlee, and Dana Greenlee is in here as well.
Nothing like e-commerce. It's continuing to grow, thank goodness, and becoming really more mainstream and part of our lives all the time. E-commerce is growing at double-digit rates, and it's continuing to replace real-world in-store sales more and more, much to their consternation. The major reason for this continual growth is the continuous improvement in the software tools that help us manage and analyze online transactions and see what works and what doesn't work. When you're an e-tailer, it's very important, and it helps you more efficiently manage the volumes of product information.
We are joined on the phone right now by Eric Best, who's the founder and CEO of Mercent.com, a Seattle-based company who's coming out of the closet of sorts with a new e-software package that is helping e-commerce retailers to submit through one interface to all the major e-marketplaces like Amazon.com, Frugal, and MySimon, and many others. And this software also search optimizes those product submissions to sell products better online. And he's going to also talk to us about the changes that online e-commerce is going through right now, and as it starts to really pull some tremendous numbers and pulling sales away from the bricks and mortar side of things as well. Welcome to the show, Eric. It's great to be speaking with you.
Thank you very much.
Can you run down with us the unique concept of Mercent and how it works and who's using it right now?
Sure. Well, Mercent is a company focused on helping retailers, catalogers, and direct marketers connect with online shoppers. And the way that we do this is by providing access to online marketplaces, such as Amazon.com, and online advertising portals like MSN Shopping and Yahoo Shopping to our retail clients. Some of the customers that are currently using our software are folks like Lucky Brand Jean, which is a NASDAQ-listed company out of California, also Wet Seal. We have ProFlowers.com, a company that folks in the Northwest should be familiar with, the Shane Company, Fortune Off, Saffron Rouge, and others.
Mercent's a fairly new company, but there's an interesting background to it. Why don't you give us some idea of kind of the metamorphosis of Mercent?
Sure. So my partners and I left Amazon in late 2000, early 2001, and we founded a consulting services company here in Seattle that provides technology marketing services to the likes of Microsoft, Amazon.com, and Lexmark. And we also have a regional information technology consulting practice. We're a Microsoft-certified partner, and we integrate and install line-of-business systems for local companies here in the Seattle area and the broader Pacific Northwest. And our mission as a company, in addition to providing these value-added services to our customers, is to discover and validate ideas for unique software products that we can bring to market. And Mercent represents the first formal entree of ours into that space.
So the whole concept really of the software is to enable easier access to all these marketplaces that exist out there, like the Frugals and the Amazon.coms. And it seems like that's kind of the next evolution of what's happening out there. There seems to be all of these different type of marketplaces that companies need to get their products visible in. And it's always been, up to this point, it's been very difficult for people to get that. And they have to go to each individual retailer and get the technology connected up. And it's probably been a problem up till now. So your technology really is to help make that easy. And why don't you kind of explain kind of how your software works with like an Amazon or a Frugal?
You bet. Yeah, so just again to restate the value, we feel that it will be increasingly important but also increasingly difficult for our retail clients to create that unique brand and product awareness through traditional online promotional channels. You know, most retailers or catalogers, folks that are selling online today, are comfortable with the concepts of email marketing and banner ads, search engine marketing and paid inclusion and so on. But we really represent access to an entirely different channel for customer acquisition and brand visibility through these marketplace partnerships. And so the way Mercent Commerce System works is we provide a single point of integration. We have a data store that acts as a staging environment for product data that is outbound in the sense of creating product listings on these online advertising portals that we mentioned earlier, as well as Amazon.com. And among these channels that we enable, Amazon is unique. Unlike a traditional ad portal like Shopping.com or BizRate or MSN Shopping, Amazon actually facilitates the entire transaction on the part of online shoppers. And so the integration with Amazon is somewhat more complex by virtue of the fact that you're dealing with not only the product data that's being posted to Amazon, but also inventory information about those products. And then in the reverse direction, our retail customers are using our software to manage the exchange of order information coming back from Amazon and ultimately financial settlement data that's coming back from Amazon. And once the integration is complete and we've sped up the process of integration, hopefully saved our retail customers some money in the integration and reduced their ongoing maintenance, then our focus shifts in terms of our value proposition to really thinking about ways that we can help our retail clients optimize their merchandising experience or the merchandising relationship that they have with these channels.
Oh, interesting. Now, the whole aspect of getting your products into Amazon, like you say, is different because it's a transactional based system. I'm sure, but the Frugals and some of the like the My Simons, those are more listing type sites and more like a search engine type of thing.
That's exactly right.
What are you finding that the e-tailers are doing? Are they linking to maybe their e-marketplace in Amazon within like a Frugal, or are they linking back to their own website? And also, one other thing, are all of your customers online with their own e-commerce?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And actually, the answer depends a lot on the specific strategy of our clients.
Mm-hmm.
But the product provides flexibility to do, really to follow any one of the use cases that you outlined.
Yeah.
So we have some customers who are listing products on Amazon and then also driving traffic to their Amazon storefront by listing through these other shopping portals.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly have some clients who are really only selling through Amazon in terms of their primary online channel. And then I think more typically you'll find companies who still maintain a private label e-commerce presence. They're selling through Amazon. They're selling through their own private label e-commerce site. And they're using these advertising portals to drive traffic to one or more of their online shopping destinations.
Okay.
So it may be a combination of both their Amazon storefront or product listings as well as their own private label e-com site.
Okay, so it gets rather complicated, I'm sure, with each of the e-tailers about what their particular strategy is on how to do that. And then you throw into the mix the whole search results with like a Google and things. How does search fit into the mix here?
Well, search is interesting, but from Mersant's perspective, there's a common thread that flows through all of the channels that we enable and all of the merchandising optimization features that we provide for our customers.
Mm-hmm.
And that common thread is the definition of an advertisement or a listing as a single product. So
mm-hmm.
we're really thinking about SKU level or unique item level merchandising on the internet. And when you think about that concept, then you start to settle on variables or attributes of products that can be dialed up or down or modified to affect the performance of the retailer's merchandising activities over time.
Mm-hmm. So it really gets back to keywords become very important, at least on that aspect of it, too. So almost like metadata for the product becomes very important
at
that
point. Yeah, I think that's a good characterization is metadata. You know, we're talking about search keywords, we're talking about the title and description of the products, the specific product mix in terms of the SKUs that are being listed on each individual channel, even things that are less obvious, like the categorization of products into a structured browse tree or hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately you get into when you start dealing with transactional partnerships with sites like Amazon.com, then you deal with decisions around inventory allocation and some of the other logistics aspects of products that may be less obvious when you're thinking about merchandising.
Oh, okay. Well, so how much control does a e-partner of yours have in the search aspects, you know, and how they come up for certain keywords? I mean, is it, you know, like in Frugal? Frugal's got a search result, and then they have sponsored links and those kind of things. Is there a certain amount of control that is given to the e-partner by category or by product?
Well, our application exposes a web-based administration console for
mm-hmm.
The retailer using our software. But I think it's safer to say that what our product provides in terms of value that supports this unique merchandising is that we provide this database environment where channel-specific or marketplace-specific data can be stored.
Okay.
And when we talk about some of the technical aspects of our product, we talk about features of our software that facilitate scheduled exchange of the data between the retailer and the marketplaces.
Okay.
Logging the data transactions in a way that information can be displayed and filtered for the administrator that's running our software. We transform data that's being pulled from the retailer's line of business systems into the appropriate format for each of the marketplace partners, and that typically involves some combination of XML web services and the transformation of data in XML documents. It could also involve integration with the retailer's line of business systems at the database level using ODBC or other database standards. And we also support just basic CSV or flat file integration.
Okay.
So we really try to take away all of the technical complexities that are involved with these marketplace relationships and allow our customers who are selling direct to consumers to focus on the business level decision making and optimization of the relationships.
Yeah, I would imagine you guys get just a flood of data back on what works and what doesn't work, and how you list a particular product on a website or as part of this feed. Do sponsored links factor into your software? Can you guys manage like the AdWords program through the software as well?
Not yet. We feel that there are plenty of vendors who have focused on that space, and by focusing our efforts on these shopping portals. That are really focused on presenting product data in a way that facilitates consumer comparison shopping and you know, a more informed buying experience, that we're going to be successful.
Why don't you run down through the list of all of the e-marketplace partners that you guys are currently working with, and is that list going to expand?
Yeah, so today, again, in addition to Amazon, which we characterize as a transactional marketplace, there are 9 other advertising portals that we support today, and they include Yahoo Shopping, Shopping.com, MSN Shopping, AOL Shopping, Nextag, Price Grabber, Frugal, MySimon, and BizRate.
You know, Eric, there are no other ones. There.
Well, there actually are a few more, and we're in the process of adding additional merchandising partners to our software. We don't have any announcements that we can make today, but we are definitely in active discussions with some other channels that will represent additional buying customers on the web.
We're having a conversation with Eric Best from Mercent.com. Stay with us because Eric has a lot more to share about his new e-commerce solution and the future of e-commerce. You're listening to Web Talk Radio.
It's all about convenience. Serenade Audio is a revolutionary new service that's redefining the MP3 player listening experience, allowing you to listen to what you want, when you want, anytime, anywhere, at your convenience. With Serenade Audio, you can download Web Talk Guys, plus over 300 news, talk, sports, and entertainment programs are available as well, and they can all be downloaded to your MP3 player with just one click. Easy and convenient.
Now, for a limited time, when you sign up for Serenade Audio, you'll receive over 100 music channels for your PC absolutely free.
To learn more, visit Serenade Audio on the web at serenadesystems.com/webtalk.
Welcome back to Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com, and my name is Rob Greenlee. Dana Greenlee is on the other mic.
And joining us right here, right now, is Eric Best. He's the founder and CEO of Mercent.com, a Seattle-based company that has come out of the closet with a new enterprise software package that e-commerce retailers are using to submit their products to big-time marketplaces.
So are we seeing kind of a evolution here into a new form of e-commerce here? You know, the whole e-marketplace concept, you know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of the time back in like 2099 when the sites like the iMall type of solutions were big and growing and popular online, but they all pretty much died.
Yep.
Is this a return to that kind of a concept where you have almost like a shopping mall online? It's just that now the tools are so much more advanced that it actually provides value to the visitor?
There are some critical benefits that these well-known marketplaces provide to retailers who are selling through these venues. Obviously, the number one benefit is customer base. I mean, Amazon has on the order of 42 million unique accounts who are actively buying. It's hard to think of another way that you can get your products exposed to that set of customers as quickly and easily as you can through a site like Amazon.com. Mm-hmm. And by the same token, I think that there are, with Yahoo, MSN, and AOL, you have established brands now that represent a certain level of quality and selection and so on in terms of the products that are being sold. So when you're at these sites, by virtue of the merchandising experience that these individual companies have, and by virtue of the selection that they provide, you can generally assume that your shopping experience is going to be better than it may have been, say, 5 years ago when any number of companies were just aggregating products left and right without necessarily providing the traffic to their merchant partners, and also without necessarily providing kind of that level of customer experience assurance, if you will, related to the shopping experience.
So really the traffic generator is really coming from sites like Frugal and MySimon, where people are going in and just doing keyword or brand searches, and then that's funneling off to the specific e-commerce sites? And
yeah, I mean, to get back to maybe a point that I brought up earlier with regard to product-level or SKU-level merchandising, one of the phrases that we throw around internally here at Mercent is this concept of distributed merchandising networks.
Mm-hmm.
And really what that means to us is that when you look at this expansion that's occurring in the way that brands and products are reaching consumers, retailers, catalogers, and direct marketers are connecting with customers where they shop and buy through partner-enabled channels like Amazon.com or these advertising portals or even affiliate programs that these e-commerce companies maintain.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a bit of an evolution in terms of online marketing and multi-channel retailing, because there's additional distance between the customer point of sale, if you will, and the seller.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of intermediaries that are involved in the promotion of the product and ultimately in the sales transaction is increasing for retailers and catalogers to maintain control over the consumer buying experience and to have control over sales performance and brand stewardship and customer experience requires that they have the ability to manage these intermediary relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what Mercent is all about.
Do you ever see these tools becoming so advanced that it really starts to make a significant dent into the existing real-world retail environment? Or are we still going to live in an environment where it's a very small minority?
Oh, I think that's a critical trend that's occurring right now, which is the inroads that are being made with regard to e-commerce as a percentage of overall online sales. I think today online sales represent on the order of 5 to 6% of total retail sales.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about 2003. But when you look at the difference between offline sales and online sales in terms of the growth trend, there was a State of Online Retailing 7.0 was released by shop.org. It was a cooperative study that was released with Forrester Research.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about $114 billion market online last year, which was a 51% increase over 2002.
Oh. Yeah.
They're talking about online sales reaching $144 billion this year, and that's continued growth in the double digits. That's relative to low single-digit growth that's happening in traditional offline retailing.
Yeah,
when our customers look at how they are going to allocate their advertising budgets and the investments that they're making in their online business versus their offline, this has to be a critical input in terms of the business decisions that they're making.
Yeah, and I guess one of the thoughts I have is, how far out do you think it's going to be before, 50% of retail is done online versus offline, I wonder?
Well, I think that's a hard question to answer. I think that there are always categories that are more appropriate for online buying and online fulfillment than others. Some of the early experiments in shipping big screen televisions riding lawnmowers, I think were met with mixed results.
What's surprising is that one of the hottest areas of e-commerce is clothing sales.
That's right.
And it's phenomenal to me because most people always wanted to try their clothes on,
Yeah.
But I guess it's the technology of being able to return stuff that's gotten better that has made that more viable now.
I think that's a great example of better operational practices on the part of the online retailer, and also just creativity in the merchandising space. The ability to evaluate these products, clothing and so on, by finding information that's valuable. Sizing comparison charts or even these three-dimensional models of the way that the clothing fits. But ultimately, I think you mentioned a really important point that in terms of the logistics, the ability to handle direct fulfillment and returns and exceptions and so on, has made it much easier to buy online. Realize that if you've made a mistake, there's an easy way to rectify the situation, and retailers are supporting customers who are returning.
Eric, your pedigree is just phenomenal because, you know, you were part of the godfather of online sales, you know, books, DVDs, music, and that was Amazon. Of course,
sure.
You were there in the early days and learn basically by working in the ditches, you know, how to really market and make that available. How exciting is it, you know, to have been there at the sort of the early stages of online retail?
Well, it's particularly exciting because Amazon is really fulfilling the, you know, the promise that was initially made when they began with these brick-and-mortar relationships with folks like Target and Toys R Us. And it's exciting to see them succeed as a service provider to other merchants. Mm-hmm. As they broaden their selection and as they make it easier for third-party retailers to sell their products through their platform, you know, everyone benefits. Consumers have better selection. Amazon sees additional traffic. And ultimately, those third-party partners have the ability to leverage Amazon's platform in a way that's beneficial to their business.
Would you say that Amazon over time is going to become less known as a retailer themselves and more as a facilitator of retail, you know, almost like an ASP or a web services company?
Well, I think from a consumer standpoint, Amazon represents, you know, Amazon talks about being the world's most consumer-focused company.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that regardless of whether or not they're representing third-party retailers or their own products, to the consumer, what Amazon cares about is providing that best-in-class, world-class shopping experience.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
Customer service and so on.
So it doesn't really matter what products or whose products. It's just offering products that use the best technology.
Yeah, I don't think it – ultimately, I think if – Amazon, as a brand, represents great customer experience, then it doesn't matter whether or not they own the product that's sitting in their warehouse or whether they're, you know, providing transactional services on behalf of other customers. I mean, one of the points that's worth noting in terms of the relationships that Amazon maintains with these merchant partners that we support is that they have pretty strict requirements for what the retailer needs to be able to do from an operational standpoint. You know, you have to be able to fulfill a product within a certain period of time if you make that commitment to the end customer. You have to be able to provide a certain level of customer service following the fulfillment of the item if a customer wants to return the product or has questions. So Amazon, I think, is doing a great job of maintaining that that customer service level,
now,
even as they expand their business model.
Do you see over time sites like Frugal becoming a little bit more like Amazon is in adding transactional ability? Is there going to be kind of a merging here, or is Amazon going to become more like a Frugal when it comes to how they – I mean, what's happening in that?
Well, I can't – it's hard for me to speculate on the future of those two companies. I mean, Google's definitely an interesting – company right now because of the in light of their IPO so they certainly have a lot of cash. I don't know, for just speaking personally, it would be hard to imagine Google deciding to get into a true online retailing infrastructure investment. And by the same token, I think because Amazon has so much domain expertise in that area, it would be hard to see them getting out of that business, you know, to become more of a pure play, you know, online service provider. Although they're certainly making interesting investments. A9, the search engine company that Amazon is investing in, is an interesting example of that.
Why don't you look out like 2 years for us and kind of give us a glimpse of what these e-marketplaces are going to look like over the, you know, over that period of time?
Well, maybe I can talk a little bit about how Mercent views the market opportunity. When
sure.
we look 2 years out, we're thinking about our retail customers, again, spending more of their advertising and customer acquisition and online commerce budgets on these distributed selling and promotional relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we really think that challenges lie, again, in terms of maintaining ownership and control over the end customer experience with regard to the brand, again, as more more partners become part of that online selling and promotional experience.
Yeah.
And so the way we're thinking about the market is, you know, as distribution increases, as the number of intermediaries increase, retailers are going to need to be thinking about the ways that they can maintain that control over their brand, over their product selection, and ultimately over the experience that their end customers have in interacting with them.
Yeah, that's certainly going to be powerful, no question about it, looking out into the future. Well, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
It's great to speak with you, and good luck to your company.
Thanks again.
That was Eric Best, founder and CEO of Mercent.com up in Seattle. Check him out at Mercent, Mercent.com. And unfortunately, that brings us to the end of another week of Web Talk Radio. Thanks so much for listening. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you very much for listening and letting us into your lives. And we look forward to having you back with us again next week to listen to our new show. And if you want to check out some of our archives, go check them out at webtalkradio.com. And you can listen to about 5 years of audio content right there. We'll see you around the net.
Thank you for downloading the Web Talk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same Web Talk Guys time, same Web Talk Guys channel.